I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. On the show today, I have an artist who Rolling Stone magazine described as infectious manic energy, a walking encyclopedia of new wave dance moves. Along with bandmate Paul Humphreys, he founded Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark in 1978. You know their songs, Electricity and Enola Gay, beats that filled dance floors around the world. Saw a lot of OMD last year. I was a soundman with the B-52s, and OMD were on tour with us. And make sure to check out my chat with the B-52 singer Kate Pearson on episode 4 if you haven't already. It's a gem. But for now, I know you're sitting back with the biscuits and the tea ready to listen to my chat with the one and only Andy McCluskey of OMD. Welcome to the Soundman Confidential episode featuring Mr. Andy McCluskey from Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. Good morning, Andy.
Greetings. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great. Well, it's morning where I am, but you're in the epicentre of a city that changed my life. Even before I knew it changed my life, you're in Liverpool.
I am, although I'm not in the epicentre of the city. I'm what's known as a woolly back. I'm from the other side of the river.
Oh. Closer to Wales. Closer to North Wales.
It's true. It's true.
A lot of people don't know that Liverpool is actually Wales light, you know.
It is. I'm on this schizophrenic peninsula between the River Merge in one side and the River Dee in North Wales on the other, and we just don't know who we are really.
And let's just go back, because I don't know very much about you, although we have traveled the continent, but I don't know that much about your early days and in terms of this investigation. It's not so much a tech thing, although we'll touch a wee bit on tech, but it's more of a vibe thing. And I'm keen to know, because the music you made, I was talking to the Simple Minds boys the other day, and they said at that time in Glasgow, nobody had a synthesizer. You know, you had to beat the bushes to find anybody with one, because they were expensive and not that common. How did you guys graduate to that direction from your very early days, before OMD, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, it started in 1975 when I heard Autobahn by Kraftwerk on radio. And I went to see them play at the Liverpool Empire on September the 11th, 1975. And I was sat in seat Q36. I remember the seat because it really was the first day of the rest of my life.
That's wild.
And I was intrigued by this because it was something different. But, you know, just like the Simple Minds guys, I mean, as a working class kid from Merseyside, there was no way I could afford a synthesizer. So Paul Humphreys and I started trying to be like our German heroes with my upside down bass guitar that was the cheapest bass guitar in the shop because it was left-handed, so I bought that. And he started cannibalizing his auntie's radios for the circuit boards and making his own noise-making machines. And that's how we started. Then we got a cheap Vox Jaguar organ and a thing called a Selma Pianotron. And we had no synths. We were writing songs right up until 78. We started the band in October 78, and we still didn't own a synth. About the first six gigs we played, we borrowed synths off friends.
Wow. Yeah. It was groundbreaking stuff back then. Funnily enough, I worked for Talking Heads for many years, and I used to play music before the show, at that time on a cassette, and I would have Kraftwerk, and everybody at the show would come up and ask me what I was playing. Because they hadn't heard, and this is 1977, they hadn't heard Kraftwerk. They'll go, what's that? So I was fortunate enough to get to kind of know those people as much as anybody could get to know them. They were serious chaps.
Very serious, yeah. Did anybody ever get to know Kraftwerk?
No.
But they were, for my money, they were the most... They have been the most important band in modern music in the last 40 years. Forget the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. Kraftwerk have influenced more in modern music than anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. saying that if it wasn't for the Beatles and Bob Dylan, I wouldn't be talking to you because they lit a fire under me. What lit the fire under you to take this path? You know, it's not something you fill out a job application for. You know,
hell no.
The career officer didn't give you a choice.
No, it was a hobby.
Yeah,
it was a hobby. I mean, because Paul and I were into. You know, things like Kraftwerk and Neu, a lot of German bands, and even the more contemporary bands we liked were kind of like Brian Eno and things, artists like that. So our mates who were all into Genesis and ELP and Pink Floyd thought that what we were into was absolute crap. They didn't get it at all. So we just used to make noises in Paul's mum's back room on a Saturday afternoon when she was at work. And that was because we didn't think that we had a hope in hell of actually doing something commercially, because what we were doing was not considered commercial. It was just our hobby. And then finally, in 1978, we dared to go on stage at Eric's Club in Liverpool, because it was there. It had a great policy of, you know, local bands on Thursday nights. And then, you know, us and all the other people from Liverpool of that generation owe it to Eric's, because, you know, they built it and we came, and that's how we started. We invented this crazy band with a stupid name for one night and one night only, and now it's coming up to 42 years later.
Yeah, the things you don't know when you leave the house in the morning.
Tell me.
But back then, I remember Eric's too. I remember the smell of the dressing room vividly. Yeah.
The smell of the whole place.
Talking heads played there, and the Ramones at the same time. It was mental.
It was a sub basement in the old pool of Liverpool, Frank. When the tide was in and it rained, the toilets used to overflow. Yeah. It was delightful.
Yeah. There's no sump pump there. Delightful stuff. So back to your early days with it, with the Vox organ and the Selmer pianotron. Were you writing beats or melody there, or how did what kept time when you in your very formative years technically? What kept time?
We used to use a tape recorder because there was only two of us. We had to use a tape recorder to play onto drums. Paul actually made an electronic drum kit. He individually copied the circuit diagrams from a drum machine and got these copper plates and electronic engineer wires and the sticks he used to use for testing, you know, the testing things for electricians. And he used to, when you touched the copper plate, you played the drum. So we had four sounds on that. And so we had that. But of course, we were only two of us on stage. We couldn't play that. So we used to have to put it on the tape. And that's how we started. I mean, we used to joke that, you know, if Lennon and McCartney had had a tape machine, they wouldn't have had Harrison and Starr, because the tape machine became our other band member. And then we found a mate who had a four-track and a studio in his garage. He went to school with Paul. And so the four-track TIAC, which was called Winston from the Hero from 1984 book, became our third member on stage. He used to sit right in the middle of the stage. And do you remember the Musicians Union used to have a campaign about Keep Music Live?
Yes, I remember very well.
We used to stick the Keep Music Live stickers on the tape spools of Winston as he went around.
pure cheek, that was. Yeah, I remember that. And then of course, in those days, what kind of PA did you have? Did you have a PA? Did you have little column speakers of any kind?
Well, interestingly, and this is why it's interesting to talk to you and about front house, we were completely and absolutely in the control of the front of house. The guy who was front of house had the tape recorder and the studio in his garage. He also worked for Vision Hire, so he had a van to drive us around, and he mixed us out front. So guess what? He became our manager. And we used to have a six-channel sort of PA head, but without speakers, which we'd plug into the PA that was in the venue at Eric's or wherever, and he would mix us off that and send a line back down the auxiliary into the speaks. We had no back line, Frank. We had absolutely no back line. We DI'd into this six-channel head, and then he would send a mix back down the auxiliary to us into the wedges on stage. And for the first over a year, that's how we did it. The guy out front with our own little subgrouped amp thing used to do the whole thing for us.
Brilliant. That's necessity is a mother of invention. Back then, you know, I worked with a little local bands too, and we had a little Shure vocal master or an amp head that we would plug into. But they were quarter inch jacks, and you could only get a 12 foot lead on that. You know, it was high impedance until you got an XLR or a Canon plug, as we called it back then. You know, a different animal.
Yes, Canons. I mean, we were very lucky, of course, because Paul Humphreys studied electronics at college, and Paul Collister, who was our manager who owned the tape recorder, was an electrician. So they knew what they were doing. We would actually turn up at gigs with our own DI boxes that were, you know, so short jack to jack into it, and then go, oh, we're ready to go. Put your Canon in there and plug us straight in, you know. So a lot of the PA companies were like, oh, you're ready to go. Yeah, okay, so you've got no backline. We don't need mics. We're just going straight out of your DI boxes. Sorted.
Great. And then did you bring your own vocal mics, or did you just use what was available?
No, it was what was available. I mean, we were literally, you know, six channels.
Yeah.
It was minimal stuff. I think, you know, the tape recorder was mono, and there was bass, the keyboards were mixed down, and the two vocals, and that was it.
Moving on a little bit, you started there, and then you started getting some gigs, and then when did you manage to get Two Bob to buy some gear? When did that happen?
Well, after we got frustrated with having to borrow synths, I mean, I can remember one of the gigs we played at Eric's when we borrowed a synth that Paul had never played before, and he just went, we've got a song called Dancing in our set. I have no fucking idea what I'm going to play on this synth. I don't know this synth. So we got the tape into the dressing room at Eric's, and we cut out this song. We just spooled it onto the floor and left it there because we didn't have a spare floor. We just dropped that song on the floor in the dressing room. So finally, we bought our first synthesizer. It was a Korg Micro Preset. And it didn't matter what button you pressed. It was violin one, violin two, trumpet, choir. It just went, eh. But it was £7.76 for 36 weeks from my mother's mail order catalogue.
Wow. What a memory.
But that's...
What a memory.
That's how you got there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's how you got there. You know, I mean, back in the 50s, rock and roll happened because electric guitars became available and people could just about afford them with a small amplifier.
Yeah.
These cheap little monophonic Japanese synths were in my mother's catalogue. That's how we got one.
It's wild. That's wild. And so how did you manage to get a record deal eventually gigging around there? Because we're going to move on to the studio production aspect from that.
We were incredibly lucky. I mean, first of all, Eric's existed, so we invented ourselves to do a Thursday night there. And they said, oh, you know, we've got friends in Manchester who have a new club and we have a reciprocal arrangement. Do you want us to ask if you can play there? We went, yeah, right. So we went down to this new club in Manchester called The Factory. And we met this guy off the telly called Tony Wilson.
A very old pal of mine.
Yeah.
God rest his soul.
Yeah. So we met him and we played in his club, and then because he was a newsreader on the local evening news for the Northwest region, he was into music, he would occasionally have bands on the news program, and we would see them there. So we thought, well, we met him last week, let's send him a cassette and see if we can cheekily blag our way on. Now, we thought this was an urban myth, but it turns out to be true because we met his ex-wife 2 years ago. And she confirmed the story. She got in the car one day and there was a plastic shopping bag in the front seat well. And she said, what's all this, love? And he went, oh, that's the reject cassettes, all these people who, you know, want to get on the TV. And she literally put her hand in the bag and pulled out the first cassette. And she went, Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark. And she, and he went, oh yeah, they played the club the other week. Not like them, rubbish. Electro nonsense from Liverpool. She said, well, let's play it. And she put it on and then she went, that's the sort of thing you should be signing. He went, no, no, it's not. And she went, yeah, it really is. And she played Electricity again. And so apparently Tony leaned over and patted her on the thigh and went, okay, love, just for you, I'll sign them. That's how you get a record deal. You were pulled out of the reject bag in the car by the wife.
Wow. That is incredibly lucky. That is, you need some of that as well. But at Source, there was a song there somewhere that somebody saw, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we still play that song to this day now. It became our first single on Factory Records, and John Peel played it. And when John Peel played it all week, it sold out. And this girl in London who started a new label under the Dindisc umbrella heard us and came to see us play at Paul's mother's back room because we didn't have any concerts. And we played all of our seven songs. She went away. And the next time we saw her, she gave us a seven album deal.
Wow.
The jammiest boys on the planet. We'd been together for 8 months, done 17 gigs, and we got a seven album deal.
That is fantastic. Well, so venturing into a recording studio with somewhat of a budget, I'm sure, and somewhat of a budget to buy machinery. How did the sound get sculpted then? Because sometimes it can be riches can be threatening to the artist. You know, you can get...
Oh, Lord, you're absolutely right.
You can disappear up your own rabbit hole, as it were.
I mean, the one good thing was that we were accustomed to working on tape. Because there was only two of us, we used to lay things down quite linear and then write onto it and build it that way. So in that respect, working, pre-recording things was not new to us. But do you know what we decided to do, Frank? We were so convinced that nobody would buy our records. So we budgeted for failure. We're right, they're going to give us £25,000. And when we make a record that nobody wants, we're going to get dropped. So instead of spending £25,000 in somebody else's studio and only having a couple of 2-inch tapes to show for it, we built our own studio so that when we got dropped, we would have our own studio in Liverpool.
Ah, very clever thinking.
And the first album was recorded in our own studio. And boy, does it sound like we just built the studio and recorded it in 3 weeks. It's a totally crappy sounding garage recording, but its naivety is now its charm.
Yeah, yeah. If the song is there and the vibe is there, you got a tune then. Then the technical, and also you were doing missionary work back then, in terms of the forum that you were following. Was there a producer involved in that, or did you just do it yourselves?
The first album we did ourselves, and then I think the record company realised that we might have good ideas, but we weren't very good engineers. So we got to work with Mike Howlett, the ex-Gong player, bass player from Gong, and he produced the third single. We re-recorded the third single from the first album, a song called Messages, and that became our first top 20 hit. And then after that, we worked with him for a couple of years, and he produced Enola Gay and Souvenir.
Yeah, I was just listening to some of this morning. So apart from Kraftwerk, your melodic influences, were any of you trained musicians?
No. I mean, Paul and I were both thrown out of the recorder group at primary school because we couldn't play. We used to sit on a table full of girls and mime and hope nobody noticed we couldn't play. And both of us did the same thing in different recording groups, and we both got thrown out when they discovered we were miming. In fact, Paul proudly displays on his wall in his house his final report from primary school. And the teacher said, music. Paul has absolutely no aptitude for music.
Well, it's the artistic way.
But, you know, in those days, nobody was a trained musician. You know, you all just did it yourself. You picked up a guitar and you taught yourself. And that's, I mean, Paul and I started writing songs from the age of 16 onwards, basically before we could play. I mean, that, you know, we were learning to play as we were trying to write songs.
That's a great thing. Yeah, because you were also around the time of the punk thing, so you had a kind of electronic punk ethos as well, where it was do it yourself, you know, yeah, without a guitar. It's like you said, guitars were cheap; they became cheaper and accessible, and the synthesizers not so much. So then you have your own little studio. Could you remember what kind of console you had in there?
It was a Soundcraft, but don't ask me what it was.
Oh, enough said.
Yeah, we had a couple of huge JBL speakers in a room that was probably only about 8 foot by 12 foot, and we were on the second floor of a warehouse in the around the Matthew Street area, just around the corner from the Cavern in Liverpool, and our control room was the converted toilet on that floor of the warehouse.
make do.
Yeah, and we built it ourselves. I mean, in fact, the first album, whilst we were recording our first album, and bear in mind we were on the first floor above ground floor, and there was 5 floors to this place. Somebody nicked the lead off the roof of the top of this abandoned warehouse. There was nothing in the 4 floors above us. And so by the time we got to do the very last song, the water was leaking into our studio. It had come through the other floors. And the last song we recorded was a song called Pretending to See the Future. If you solo my lead vocal on Pretending to See the Future, you can hear that I'm standing with 6 buckets around me with water dripping into them.
Stealing lead off of roofs is a thing. People don't realize.
Those were the days.
There's an expression in Scotland that if you're a chancer and you make good, that people say it's a lot of lead off of one roof, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, you could, if you got lucky, you could get rich.
Yes, indeed. So, did you playing live coming out of that first album? Did you had a tape machine as well? You had a 4-track or something, or sequencers or loops. I don't think there was that many loop machines back then. You had a space echo and with a bit of chorus on it, but that was limited to one thing, you know?
Yeah. No, we were very much... We finally decided after sort of 16 months of being a two-piece, because we were a two-piece by default, that when we were going to go out on tour and do our first proper headline tour with our first album, we would be a four-piece. And two of our mates who, you know, had spurned us when we were doing our weird stuff a few years, suddenly wanted to be in the band when we had a contract and we could pay them. But we were determined to not fall into the rock and roll cliches. So we wanted to build our own electronic drum kit. And our poor mate Malcolm, who'd been a drummer since he was 13, he was one of the few good drummers on the Wirral Peninsula. So he was in about 8 different bands. You know what it's like when you're teenagers. You know, the good drummer, everybody wants it.
Yeah.
We built this kit for him. And it broke down on the first 2 gigs because it was like practice pads with these like contact mics in them. And I think he was hitting the contact mics on purpose to break it so that he could have a real kit back. But we tried our homemade kit, but it didn't work. We went out on the road as a four-piece, and that's when we shifted to a four-piece. But instead of 2 guitars, bass and drums, it was 2 keys, bass and drums.
Ah, did you at that time were you playing places where you had to close mic the drums and close mic everything else and someone mix it out front?
Yeah, I mean that was when actually we finally moved over to allowing somebody from the PA company who was more accustomed to miking up a kit and doing a bigger rig to actually take over front of house from the guy who had the Vision Hire van, who was our manager. because he decided to stay in the office in our home-built studio because the manager, you know, it was starting to get busy. The manager had to stay in the office. He couldn't be out on the road with the band.
Yeah, there was no mobile phones back then. You couldn't be...
No, God, no, no. No faxes, no mobile phones, no email. I mean, so you had to be on the end of a landline where people knew you were going to be.
Yeah, I often think back. I started touring in 72 professionally, and there was no phone, no fax. And we did European tours with a bit of paper telling you where to go on each day, you know. Mm-hmm. And we never missed a gig. And we found everything without... GPS. Mm-hmm. How did we do that?
I feel you do look back and think that, don't you?
I know, and I'm going. But I mean, and also we were very stoned back then. How do you find out? Asking someone in a petrol station where you don't even speak the language.
Well, don't worry. Now that we've got Brexit, we're going to be going back to things like that and having carnets and, you know, grumpy border officers at 4 a.m. making the crew empty the truck because they want to see the base that's behind the PA just to fuck you around, you know?
Remember that, laddie. I don't miss those days.
Oh, no. Well, it's coming back thanks to Brexit.
Oh, dear. Well, we won't get political, but yeah. The consequences for people who tour, which we're talking about as the live thing here, is crucial. It's going to drive up costs. Well, the driving regulations in Europe drove up costs, you know, but we won't go there. These days, I don't think there's any excuse for a band sounding bad with the gear we've got. What do you think?
Oh, I mean, the new line array systems and things are so much more efficient and perfect. I mean, I will say one thing that although when you stood on stage, you didn't know what the sound was like out front, we only had a few front of house sound men. Once we got somebody who we believed in, we stuck with them for years and years and years. And I tell you why, because when I don't know, because you're out the front, you're mixing the sound. But when you stand on the stage, particularly in the old days, when it was the big boxes, the the whole side of the stage was just a mountain of black boxes.
Martin Burns, I remember them well. They sounded fantastic.
Yeah, but it was quite kind of directional. You got all sorts of hot spots and low spots. When you stood on stage, especially where I was at the middle of the front, I didn't know what the sound was like out front, but you know what? I knew when it was a good mix because the stage physically felt better.
Yeah.
You know, you could feel that PA vibrating the stage, and when it was all locked together, clean, tight, and loud, it just, the stage felt right. It didn't feel muddy. It didn't feel bad. It actually, you physically felt the stage vibrating in a way that was satisfying, so you knew kind of intuitively that the sound was good out front because you could feel it good on stage.
Yeah.
Strange thing to say, but it's true.
It's true. And I think what happens with, because the line arrays are flowing and the bass bins are on stage, you can feel a bit of bass, but you don't get that whole warm thing locked in. Not all the time, I don't think. I'm not on stage, so I don't know, but I've listened to a few bands in the wings, but I'm not out there in the middle of the stage during the show. But you can also tell when the audience are getting it because of the reaction as well. Mm-hmm. When the audience are getting a good mix, and people don't leave their houses and pay money to have a bad time, you know. Especially
no,
these days.
They want. But do you know what's interesting, Frank? We toured a few years ago with a band who will remain nameless, who did not have their usual front of house guy. He was on something else. And they had somebody else doing the sound. And we had our normal guy. And everybody we met on that tour said to us, "You sounded like a live version of the record. And so-and-so, oh, they've lost it, man. They sounded terrible. And so-and-so can't sing anymore." And I went, "No, actually, it's just the guy out front. He's too loud and he's distorting the band. And you can't hear the singer because everything's not well balanced." But this is the thing, is that the audience don't know what's going on. They don't know that the band might be flawless on stage, but the guy out front is not doing them any justice. And so they just think, oh, you know, they sound rubbish, they're rubbish, I don't want to see them anymore, they sounded terrible, couldn't hear the vocals, can't sing. They make all these assumptions just because the... So you really are in the palm of the hand of the front of house guy. If you give him the best you can and he does a poor mix, you're screwed.
Yeah, yeah. I did... I work with the B-52s now, as you know, and I stopped touring for a while, for many years, and I went back. They called me up. I did a couple of shows with Chris and Tina with Tom Tom Club, and we opened for the B-52s, and afterwards their manager came up and said to me, how come your band sounded better than mine tonight? I said, well, it can't be the gear because I'm mixing with hardly anything, support band style, barely got a sound check. So I said, so it must be me. He said, can we steal you? I said, no, you can purchase me. So, and that's happened to me before. It happened to me at the Montreal Jazz Festival with the B-52s. And I didn't get a sound check and it sounded amazing. And we were opening the show for, it was the Pet Shop Boys. And the Pet Shop Boys agent standing at the front of house desk asking me to go and pull their guy off the mixer. Two songs in,
yeah.
He said, go in. I said, I can't do that. And because it's so easy. Well, for me, it's so easy. But it's life or death with your sound in electric music, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, there's nothing professional about me, but I care. Yeah, that's the difference. I care.
But that is the difference. And you know, it's... People say, you know, when you go on stage every night, you know, how do you manage to give 100% every night? And you just go, well, because those people in the audience didn't see you the night before. Yeah. You traveled so many hundreds of miles, you're in a different town. To you, it's the 15th gig of the tour or the 57th gig of the tour. But to those people in the crowd, that's the only one they're going to see. And you have to lock that into your head. You give the best you can and you expect all of the crew to do the same. And I think that, you know, that your attitude is admirable, because if you dial it in, if you don't care, you get a sloppy, bad mix. And then people go away going, oh, they don't say Frank Gallagher's rubbish. They go, that band is rubbish.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. It's true. I just had a little train of thought there. As a support band. So the other thing coming up, there was a time in England where if you were a support band, you got nothing. You barely got a sound check. You barely got a microphone. You know, there was some PA companies that wouldn't treat you very well as an opening act. And you just toured with us, with the B-52s, and everybody got a sound check every day. And I've made that my policy. Doesn't matter. I'll cut my band short to give everybody else on the bill a sound check every day. And that was not always the case when I grew up in England and Scotland and Europe. Did you ever experience that?
Yes, I have done. We've been fortunate that the first tour we ever did in the autumn of 79, we were still a two-piece, and we supported Gary Numan on his big Cars tour after his two number one singles. And he was very kind to us because we hadn't actually made an album yet. And he said, well, listen, you haven't got any money, but I want you, and you suit me because there's two of you, so you can be in front of the curtain because I've got a massive production behind you. So it was a symbiotic relationship. He said, I like your music, you're great. But if you've got no money, you can put your gear on my truck. You can come on my bus. You know, I will get my security man to introduce you. So, you know, you can be treated well by people who are not up their own rear end, who are not frightened of you, who believe in themselves enough to want to have a good band and have a proper show. I think it's when, you know what it's like, basically, it cascades down from the band and the tour manager. And if the band have got issues, or there's some politics, it tends to trickle all the way down and everybody gets treated badly and everybody feels grumpy and everybody's looking behind their back. if the headline acts are comfortable in their skin and all their crew know these guys are great, they're doing a good job, we're doing a good job, we're appreciated, everybody gets treated better.
Yes.
And I mean, particularly the tour that we did last year, you know, it was great. We got treated really well. It was a package. And I think that was what, you know, all the bands realized that, you know, we were all there as part of the ticket.
Yes.
I mean, the B-52s were the headline act, but the other artists were filling out the value of the ticket. And if the first two bands are treated badly and sound bad and look bad, it reduces the quality of the offer to the audience, doesn't it?
The power of the package. Yeah, and in situations like that, I don't use the word headliner. We close the show. That's it. We just close the show. There's no headliner. It's the power of the package. You know, I did it with, I toured with Buddy Guy for years, and we had Buddy and B.B. King and some other acts, and it was the power of the package. And there was no...
There was the
leave your ego at the door and get on with it for the audience. I've got to say that I listened to Joan of Arc this morning, and it sounds so Scottish, the intro. I mean, I know you're Scottish, basically. Scottish Irish, McCluskey.
My dad's from Glasgow, and the name's Irish.
Yeah, and it's like me, I'm Gallagher, and my dad's from Ireland, and I was born in Scotland, so, you know, it's the usual, one half of me wants to drink and the other half doesn't want to pay for it.
Can I steal that one?
Can have that one, lad. It's reinforcing cultural stereotypes, but there's a reason they're stereotypes. It's like the difference between a Scotsman and a coconut. You know, you can get a drink out of a coconut. All the old ones. But it's, can you speak to that some of the cultural influences in your music and where you draw from? And how Scottish are you, by the way? How Scottish are you?
I was born in England.
Right.
My dad came down as a semi-professional football player to play for New Brighton, across the river from Liverpool. So he was engineering at Camel Airs on the Ark Royal and playing football. But I used to go to Scotland. We used to go on holiday all the time to Scotland. I mean, you know, he was my dad. I understood him, but he'd been in England for most of his life. And my band members couldn't understand. I had to have to translate for him. You know, he had a pretty broad accent. So, we have two songs called Joan of Arc. There's Joan of Arc, Little Catholic Girl, and there's Joan of Arc Waltz with the da na 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 na.
Yes, that one.
And
that sounds so Scottish to me.
Well, do you know why? Because I was absolutely influenced, and the drums were stolen. I was watching the Edinburgh Military Tattoo.
Exactly.
And I loved it. And so the drum pattern was kind of aping the military drums of the Tattoo with the and I'm telling you, that sound, it sounds like a bagpipe, but it's actually a violin off a mellotron. But it's the Edinburgh Military Tattoo about a French saint.
Well, that's,
you got it. You absolutely got it, Frank.
I started, I never played anything, but I went to some pipe band rehearsals in the village hall, and we played on a table, and I was starting to learn the drums. It didn't work out for various reasons. I didn't keep it up. But the one thing I did do was when the guys were practicing with the drums, when they had pigskin and catgut on the snare, that's the snare drum sound, not even military, but a pipe band snare drum sound is what I've always gone for, with a bit of meat and a snap as well. You know, as soon as I heard that Joan of Arc thing, I went, that took me right back to a pipe band drum sound. And it's funny where we get our influences from, you know. And I've got a couple of little, I'm not a technocrat, you know. I'll put a mic in front of something and I'll use whatever we've got, you know. I've never had an unlimited budget for a tour. So I've always had to work on a budget with any band. In fact, I'm known for working on a budget. I've never brought anything in over budget ever. You know, it must be the Scottish thing in me. What are your earliest memories of feeling something not hearing it, but feeling musicality.
Mm. When I was a kid growing up, my mother had a mono Dansette record player. So everything was, you know, one of those ones with the arm that comes across and stacks 10 singles at a time, scratches them to hell, you know. And it had the weediest, most horrible tinny sound. And I can remember in like 1970, we got in, I mean, secondhand, I don't know where we got it from, everything in my house was secondhand. We got a stereogram that sat in the front window by the telly, and that had big speakers in it. And it was a revelation. Suddenly there was like, what's all that at the bottom? There's all this other sound that's not, there's all this boom, boom, boom. I was like, that was absolutely mind-blowing. Suddenly there was a speaker that wasn't 4 inches, it was 10 inches.
And low end, yeah. My granny had one, but we could never play it loud, unfortunately. But we'd listen to the Goon Show on it, you know. And
yeah, so it is, when you first hear bass end, when you haven't been to a gig and you haven't heard a PA, it's like, wow.
Yeah, yeah. I thank you very much for your time today. It's been very insightful. It's been nice to catch up with you. Soundman Confidential, signing off with OMD. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Take care, Frank. Bye.
Hey, thanks for plugging in. We can't do without you. And if you can, please consider supporting the show so that we can keep it running through 2021. Go to our website at soundmanconfidential.com to find the link and to check out our amazing upcoming guest list. Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black and Chet Bentley, web design by Adelaide Bell, original music by Paul Westwater, and publicity by Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.